today we're talking about alternative architecture in conjunction with an exhibition that's about to open very soon, this week in fact, at the Tin Sheds Gallery at the University of Sydney. And the exhibition is called Not Quite Square, and it's the story of the Northern Rivers architecture. And it's all about the architectural adventures of a community in the Northern Rivers. It's a community that emerged in the region following the 1973 Aquarius Festival at Nimbin, and their wonderful homes, all designed, made and lived in by people who have chosen to live outside the square. So I'm very pleased to be joined by my panellists. Lee Stickles joins me. He's a senior lecturer in architecture and urban design at the University of Sydney. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, Fennell.
Erwin Weber, here too, an architect who arrived in the late 70s after the festival. Is that right, Erwin?
Yes.
Okay. Also very heavily involved with the owner-builder community. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Fenella.
And Carly McLaughlin, who is a long-term resident of one of the oldest multiple occupancies in the Northern Rivers, who built her dome in the early 1970s. Welcome to you, Carly.
Hello.
Lee, let's start with you. Take me back to 1973, the time around this festival. Why did people want to escape the cities?
There were many reasons, but we could boil it down to disillusionment and desire and pragmatics. There was a cross-section of the community, particularly young people who were disillusioned with the way society was going. You know, we'd had the Vietnam War. They felt that society was too money-driven and conservative and so on. So they desired to live in other ways. And where are you going to do that? Well, the pragmatics came in that the Northern Rivers, the dairy industry had fallen over, banana plantations had fallen over, the land was cheap, and then the Aquarius Festival happened and so kind of catalysed it.
And that's when, Carly, you decided to stay, is that right?
Oh, security in numbers, of course. We all moved to the same region.
And, Lee, what was the motivation, though, I mean, from your perspective, as a historian in this aspect, to build their own houses? What was the genesis for the growth of these sort of self-building communities?
Again, it's a range. So for some, it was about that living communally. So that's where the multiple occupancies emerged, because people were wanting to experiment with collective forms of living that they weren't able to do elsewhere. Part of that, and also more of an emphasis for other people, was just to live autonomously, to not be systems dependent, to be off the grid, and to be more sustainable, although the word wouldn't have been used so much at that point. Yeah, to live more in a more environmentally conscious way.
And was there a significant building experience in at that time, do you think, Lee?
Amongst the people?
Yes. Before I ask the people.
Again, it was a real range, because some of the people that went up there were architecture dropouts, trained as architects or architecture students. Others were, completely naive. So you had a real range of experiences.
Okay. And before I get on to Carly and Erwin, just quickly, what were the sorts of structures that we could see in this area? Describe some of them for me.
Initially, lots of tents and caravans and pole structures and so on. Moving into when people started to build themselves more permanent homes, the domes, mud brick housing, stabilised earth, the domes were often ferro concrete. Timber, a lot of timber that was taken from site, and also a lot of, you know, early experiments in recycling and salvaging.
Okay.
So the salvaging of whole buildings that were then recomposed and reassembled as houses.
All right. Tell me about your home, Carly, because we've talked about domes and you're living in a dome which you built in at this time as well. What does your dome look like? Describe it for me.
It's a ferrocement shell. The important thing about it is where it is rather than what it is.
Okay.
It's on top of a cliff. It's in turpentine forest, older turpentine forest, and it doesn't have a road. It's invisible from the air. So it's using a site that was of no value, which is something we'd learnt possibly from Sydney. Don't do anything on valuable real estate. And also we were trying to keep off agricultural land because we didn't have much of it. It was a very steep and infertile valley, and gardens were precious.
And why build a dome? What was the motivation for that for you?
In a forest, things fall down from above. And also, it's strong and it doesn't burn terribly well because it's a cement shell. And also, I didn't need to know much building.
So you built this yourself?
everybody built everybody's house in the particular region I was at. But I was influenced by several people from the Rushcutter Bay Cruising Yacht Club, actually.
Why is that? Oh, because they had the yachting experience and the rigging experience.
And ferrocement hull experience.
Okay.
It was quite a fashion at that time.
Erwin, what about for you? Because I know that you are an architect and you moved to this area in the late 1970s as well. What did you decide to build? What happened when you first got there?
Well, firstly, we collaborated with a lot of local people and we became part of the Wollumbin Owner Builders Cooperative, and we did pole raisings together. We actually loved the rainforest area and we seriously wanted to learn how to design passive solar buildings for the subtropics. And actually we don't, there's all, you can extend the range that Lee talks about from just disillusioned and dropout, it actually extends to people who were altruistic and believed in designing better cities. We were working in Sydney on the Glebe during the Whitlam years. We were actually trying to create functional communities.
And this is what you were doing in this area, was actually activating that.
It was very ethical. And we were very serious about it. It wasn't just sex, drugs and rock and roll. We were actually trying to build a future for our children.
Did you think that you were doing something very different, though, at the time?
Yes, of course. But our experience included living in Melanesia, Polynesia, New Guinea, Indonesia, and co-building wedding houses in Vanuatu and documenting that as a research thing. So architecture is a very broad range, and our influence was with Indigenous people, and it moved us away from mainstream North Sydney architecture practice
to doing something in a more community feel. So,
yes.
But how did you do it? Let's just talk about, you know, making it in the first place. If as Carly, as you said, you hadn't had much experience building a dome before, I imagine, how did the community get together? Did everybody drag building materials around?
We supported each other. The cooperative actually, 10, 20 people would get together and poles were very accessible in a lot of durable hardwoods. So starting, you'd network with your neighbours and a big day would be arranged and everyone would come with their gear and knock a few chickens on the head and a few beers. And in a day you'd have the structure would be up with 20 people. It's sort of like a barn raising. Mm, and that was a beautiful experience in my memory.
How long did it take to build your dome, Carly?
It took about a year of meshing and weaving of the steel, and then a great big spaghetti day happened and 18 people turned up and threw 10 tonnes of mortar all over it.
And it's there standing today?
Yes.
Okay. Let's just quickly talk about the dome because I find that structure itself quite interesting. Lee, what was the motivation for the dome beyond the fact that obviously it's a beautiful structure? Where did it come from, this idea?
Carly's sort of pointed out a couple of reasons why you might use a dome or want to build a dome. Other reasons that were in the air were that for some the dome had a spiritual content to it. There was a space of the universe. In a less spiritual way, it was also just it wasn't square. So, sometimes
quite literally not square.
Yeah, literally not square, but also not square in the sense of being too conservative. So, for some people, if you were going to move into this area and do things differently, you didn't want to just build yourself an A-frame chalet.
But structure. It was the lectures and the work of Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah. Well, spent a day with him in 1970 at Sydney Uni. There was a student festival here and Buckminster Fuller came and he was inspirational. So he blew our socks off. Mm. He was 80-year-old with a bullet bald head and he just spoke like a machine gun and we were hung on to every word. It was just amazing, his concept of minimal space and great yoga spaces, meditation
spaces.
That's
a good point. But each moment, I suppose, each house that you assisted with, you helped build, you learnt more and more. So you shared building techniques, you shared ideas. How did those ideas get shared around, Carly? What was it?
Straight experience of seeing other people build things and get things right and get things wrong. And
it's called participatory design, academically, where you collaborate and you do experiential learning. and you learn on the job. Even if you think you're professional and you've got knowledge, you actually have to start again and work with the materials at hand, because we used mostly recycled and on-site materials. So we were actually experimenting with local materials, on-site materials, rather than going to a big warehouse and getting a semi-load of materials. We were actually fossicking and finding,
using the stuff that's out there already and
yes,
reusing it.
That's right.
We've heard about Carly's home, which is a dome, and how that was built. But describe your home, Erwin.
Well, the river house is an octagon, and with a mezzanine. And the roof, we actually experimented with shingles, but in a forest that had fire hazard. And we ended up learning how to do ferro concrete very well. So, and it's still there 33 years later, and it's a much-loved building. And ferro concrete, we helped other people learn how to do it, because you could mould the gutters and shapes, and it was free form. But you had to do, you couldn't experiment with it. You experiment on the dunny, you know, and then you work on the house.
So
and
try,
we experiment on ourselves and then other people. So it was all experimental. And it was lovely to be able to work in the round and off out of sight of the
out
square.
Out of sight. What about the reactions from the local community about putting in housing that perhaps is, as you say, it's outside the square? So there's rules and there's regulations that, you know, strata details, blah, 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 that everybody has to deal with. What was happening there at the time?
Oh, it's a nightmare. We're harassed by, well, we're terrified of the police and the council, and the corporate body was trying to get everybody to make things as low-key as possible so as not to draw fire. We had demolitions, and we had major police invasions, and it was all quite nasty.
And what about things like even getting the power on and plumbing and for it to all
standards?
Well,
we were off the grid.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. But also, building inspectors and planners, I've got on very well with them, because essentially you needed to deal with structure, safety and health. And if you get that well detailed and well, so they actually liked the fact that you were innovative. The area that was difficult was proving to them that dry composting toilets and reed beds and water management systems that weren't traditional were healthy, and we had to prove that. So we set precedents there, and they thought you could only do that on 100 acres in the bush. But we know that there are dry composting toilets in Chippendale.
Yeah.
And they if they're built well, they actually are sustainable.
Yeah. Lee, from your perspective as an architectural historian and obviously visiting these houses and thinking about, you know, the way of living that we're talking about here, owner-builders in the northern New South Wales, of New South Wales, this kind of alternative lifestyle that's described as, it's quite adventurous, I suppose. Is there a bit of an envy, do you think, of this sort of imagination and the culture that's here?
Well, I came to the project because I had been doing work on, I guess, alternative architecture practices, contemporary alternative architecture practices, and then realizing that this stuff had been happening at our own doorstep in the 60s and into the 70s, and the more that I researched, the more interesting I found the material, and the more admiration that I came to have for the people that were actually did it. It required so much dedication, so much time and effort. And these people were really, kind of path-breaking in terms of sustainable building practices.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think in some ways as the housing that you built as alternative housing, or perhaps you were just simply ahead of the curve, ahead of the game completely? What do you think, Carly?
We're obviously a bit ahead of the curve. Well, as...
Yes, I agree.
We were a bit ahead of the curve, but there's also endemic problems with provision of infrastructure, and there's such a power to do things the ordinary way. There's a force to have a road, and there's a force to have a licensed disposal system and a garbage bin out the front and all the normal things that the council likes to do. And we suffered badly because of amalgamation of local councils, and suddenly the city-centric view was imposed on us.
So how do you get around that to maintain what it is that you want?
Well, that's why I'm talking about it being an ongoing fight.
Mm. It's well documented. Ecologically sustainable development has grown out of these experiments over the last 40 years. And what we experimented was the forerunner of ecological systems. And now we know that deep green systems, nature can do it for you for free. And it's actually called ecotechnology. You actually do your water management, your energy, your nutrient cycling on site, and it's healthy. Mm. So it's actually doing things more sustainably.
Are the buildings finished? It sounds like there's an ongoing project. Is the dome finished? Is everything finished?
I need to repair it from some white ant damage a couple of years ago.
Okay. Yeah. How about for yours, Erwin?
Well, it's 30 years and never ending, but our children are sort of coming back and they're 30 now and it's theirs, so it's intergenerational and it will never finish. I hope that it's our children and their children will love it. Because we've restored a log flog ex banana farm, and it's now of value.
And there's space for new buildings, of course, as well, that still exists.
I've got to bring in a new force which has come under the picture, which is the mania for certification and liability cover. We've come up against a whole new phase of obstruction. Not the police anymore; it's the insurance companies and what they think is proper duty of care. So it's getting harder and harder
to do what you were doing in
for anything that someone thinks is dangerous or someone thinks you're not carrying your insurance.
The second dwellings on farms, even our traditional farmers want their sons and daughters to be able to live in it. And the reality is in the Byron, Northern Rivers and Southeast Queensland, probably even here, there are thousands of people who are living below the radar. And we're involved in co-housing projects at Mullumbimby, and we've got to deal with people who want to live differently. Because at the moment, people living in tents and teepees and caravans and street people need better housing. And real estate's not dealing with that.
It's something I think that here on By Design we'll certainly need to follow up. Before we go, though, I might, Lee, as somebody who's a visitor and doesn't live there, maybe you could nominate, do you have a favourite structure in the area you could just describe for me very quickly?
Oh, that's a good way to have me alienate all these lovely people that I met. Not a particular favourite, but I guess a defining moment was trekking up the side of the hill barefoot, through the mud to reach Carly's Dome, which was our first visit. That's pretty special.
It's certainly worth a look at. And if you do get a chance to go along and look at the exhibition, again, it opens at the Tin Sheds Gallery at the University of Sydney. It's opening this week. And I do thank my guests for joining me here on By Design. It's wonderful to meet you. Lee Stickles, Erwin Weber and Carly McLaughlin, thank you so much for coming in and dropping by.
Thank you for me.
And, of course, you can find some links and more information on our guests and that exhibition on our website at abc.net.au/radionational.